we're back with hour two of the U.S. Phone Force here on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Keep in mind that our call-in number is 1-800-313-9443, and we will get back to the call-ins shortly. But let me first say a word about our sponsor for this hour. Our sponsor is The Bible Says. Are you looking for answers to what's happening? Then call 888-211-1715 and request packet F. This is a free packet to all RBN listeners. This packet contains many free DVDs and books like National Sunday Law, The Great Controversy, The Secret Terrorists, and much more. That toll-free number is 888-211-1715. Now we're back with hour two of the U.S. Phone Force, and as I mentioned before the break, we have a pre-recorded interview with State Senator Dianne Black. And so we've adjusted the program schedule a little bit to spill this over into hour two, because I believe that this topic has implications nationwide, and I would especially ask our affiliates in Tennessee, those of you listening in Tennessee, to pay special attention. But this has implications nationwide. If this constitutional amendment is passed, I believe that other states will look to Tennessee as a model for inserting this into their state constitutions. And that's why I think that this is a topic that bears discussion on a national network. And so we're about to bring up that recorded interview. Now, again, I mentioned in the first hour there is a possibility that a special guest will be calling in. And if that happens, then we will interrupt the interview temporarily to take our well-known guest caller. And if that happens, it will be very much worth the wait. So keep listening to this pre-recorded interview with State Senator Dianne Black of Tennessee.
Yes, I can.
Oh, is this Senator Black?
It is.
Ah, welcome aboard. This is
Thank
Tom
you.
Kovach. And I hope that Sherry explained to you, we're going to be able to edit this. This is all going into a computer server at the radio network.
Okay.
We can chat a little bit if you'd like to get ready. You don't have to be quite your on-air personality just yet if you don't want to.
Sure.
But, how much time do you have available for this interview?
I'm okay, so I don't really have anything after this for a while.
Okay, very good. The main thing that I wanted to talk to you about, and we'll just get right into it then, let me pull up my sound switchboard so that I can bring in a little bit of sound effects and that sort of thing. I like to bring in my guests with sound effects.
Okay.
So, just a moment. Attention members, please help me to welcome our guest, Senator Dianne Black. Senator Black, welcome to the U.S. Phone Force.
Well, thank you, Tom, for having me today.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Just for our listeners that are not in Tennessee, a little bit of bio information. You were in the Tennessee State House for two terms before you joined the Senate. And you're now in your second term, I believe, in the Tennessee State Senate?
Just a little bit of a correction. I served for three terms for 6 years in the House of Representatives before deciding to run for the State Senate. And I am completing my first term and will be up for re-election this coming fall.
Oh, boy. Well, I certainly hope that happens. You have a very interesting background. Registered nurse. Rotarian of the Year in your home Rotary Club in 1993. Volunteer of the Year for the YMCA in 2001. American Cancer Society Legislator of the Year in 2003 and Tennessee Right to Life Legislator in 2004. And that pretty much brings us to our topic. You're rather well known for being a champion of the unborn and specifically trying to introduce into the Tennessee State Senate a constitutional amendment to protect the unborn. Would you tell our listeners about that, please?
Sure. This comes as a result of a Supreme Court decision that took place back in the year of 2000. And there was a lawsuit that was brought against our state by Planned Parenthood. That was the Planned Parenthood versus Sundquist. And in that, what was found is that our state Supreme Court judges in a 4-1 decision made a decision that the right to abortion was considered a fundamental right. And I know that for those that are not in the legal profession, and I'm not an attorney, that may bring up a thought of, well, why is that so significant? The significance of that is once it was determined that it was a fundamental right, all of those things that were on the books that protected women that had made that decision about having an abortion, all of those protections that were in place in our Tennessee Code annotated were then ruled unconstitutional. And just for the listeners' understanding, those three things were put into place after the Roe versus Wade decision in 1973, and they were really put into our Tennessee Code annotated to protect women so that when they did decide to have an abortion that they would have a opportunity to be fully informed and have a safe procedure. And those three things that were stricken down by our Supreme Court were informed consent, full informed consent, a 48-hour waiting period, and the requirement that a second trimester and above abortion would be done in a hospital setting. And so before we can get back to restoring those and putting those common sense protections back into our Constitution, we must have an amendment.
Interestingly enough, as you point out, none of those three measures in and of itself restricts the so-called right to an abortion. It merely presents some safeguards.
That's correct.
I've heard you say in other talk radio interviews here in the Nashville area with Steve Gill, Phil Valentine, Michael Del Giorno, that you would never go into a hospital or a surgical center and have any other surgical procedure done without fully informed consent. The doctor will tell you what type of anesthesia they're going to use, what the potential risks are, the potential side effects, et cetera, and only after all of those have been explained to you, then you sign a consent form, okay, I'm willing to have this operation.
That's exactly right, and even something just as minor as having a toenail removed requires that a doctor give you full informed consent. They tell you what the procedure is going to involve, how they're going to do the procedure. And in most cases, you're going to have some time period to think about it. And it's rare for you to go and have a doctor take a look at you and say, this is a surgery that I think we need to perform, and to have the doctor say, well, by the way, I just want you to jump up on the table, and we're going to do that right now. It usually gives a patient an opportunity to think more about it, to understand what the doctor has said, and then to make a decision and indeed change their mind if they don't want to. And so that is the reason for the 48-hour waiting period, is it does give someone an opportunity that is making a very large decision in their life to think more about what they've heard from the healthcare professional, from the doctor. And we no longer have that requirement here in our state.
And as you point out, that is actually, by taking that safeguard away, potentially puts the patient at risk. And the state Supreme Court claimed that they're trying to protect women's rights. But since men don't have an abortion and this takes away medical safeguards from women, who are they actually protecting?
Well, that's a very good question. And when you'd say, well, if it's someone's right to privacy to have a surgical procedure done, why is it any different if we were to go to have a gallbladder taken out or any other, an appendectomy? Is it not the right of privacy for everyone to have that right? Well, of course it's a right to privacy, but we have, as a public safety matter, the authority in the General Assembly to make sure that we do safeguard people. And this is a surgical procedure. If we take all of the emotional feelings out of this, this comes right down to being a surgical procedure. And is it fair to a woman that we would not protect her as we would protect anyone in any other surgical procedure by these very important and consistent types of things that we do in surgical procedures?
You're absolutely right, Senator. And that language, what you just said, you said something very similar the other day on the air with Michael DelGiorno, and that prompted me to think about the entire abortion argument in a whole new way. And I wrote a column based on that new thinking, and I emailed it. You may not have seen it. It just came out a couple of days ago on Renew America, which is where I have a recurring column.
Mm-hmm.
And the title of it was called Changing the Language of Abortion. Now, the left, for many years, has used the argument that the fetus is merely a part of a woman's body, and therefore they can do whatever they want with it, just as, for example, what you use, having a toenail removed. And according to the left, this is no different. Now, those of us on the right, for many years, have used the argument that, well, genetically, the fetus is different from either the mother or the father. The fetus has some traits of both, but is a unique human being from the moment of conception, therefore has the right to life according to the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. So those two views seem to be at complete odds with no possibility of reconciliation. So what I said in this column was, what if we agree with the left momentarily? And how I choose to do that is I said we need to change the language to refer to an abortion as a fetal amputation. And an amputation is a serious surgical procedure that requires serious safeguards. Once you have a body part amputated, you can't get it back. You don't unring the bell. And so if we were to put in place through legislation the same medical safeguards for an abortion that are in place for an amputation, many of those things that you just described, which the Tennessee Supreme Court has temporarily ruled unconstitutional, would come back with or without a constitutional amendment. Your thoughts?
Well, and we can get into a whole discussion about when does life begin. I think back in 1973 when that discussion was occurring, it was in a different era, certainly 30 years ago, 35 years ago now. We did not know as much about conception, although many, many, many researchers and scientists had proven even at that point in time that there, once at conception, if let to its fullest maturation, it would be a human life. So if we argue that it's just a blob, I kind of draw this analogy to a weed and a flower. And bear with me for just a moment because it maybe is a little stretch of an analogy, but I am somebody that likes analogies because I'm a picture person and
me
helps
too.
Me to put things in place. If we say that a weed seed, as it grows, is not ever going to be anything different than a weed, then we would pluck it because it's never going to be any different than a weed. But if we then say that what is planted, that is a human life at conception, it's not a weed. It's a flower all the way from the beginning. And if let go, it will be a life or a flower at the end. And so when people argue and say, oh, well, it's just a blob, it is not just a blob. It is a life. It is a flower. And if let go, it will be a full flower and it will blossom. A weed is a weed and a flower is a flower. And we're talking about life here, and this would be a flower if we were to let it go. And so we can get into that whole argument about when does life begin, and I think you will find that people on the left will continue to argue that it is nothing but a blob. But they can't argue that point that if it were let go, it would be a life. And as a matter of fact, if you've ever seen a rendering of once someone goes into the uterus with an instrument, a suction instrument is what they use in these abortions, that you will actually see this blob or this fetal embryonic material begin to move away from that instrument, because already, even at that very young age of just a couple of weeks after conception, it senses danger, and it will actually move away. And there are ultrasounds that are done to show what happens when an instrument enters into that environment, a safe environment traditionally for an embryo, that you actually see a reaction of that tissue. So we do have much more sophisticated technology today than we did back 35 years ago. We can actually save a baby much earlier these days than we could back 35 years ago. 35 years ago, you'd say a baby of anything less than 30 weeks would not be able to be saved. Well, they have saved babies now all the way down to 20 weeks. So we have backed up what people argue to be a sustainable life from 30 weeks back down to 20 weeks. And who knows, as technology goes on, we may even be able to do better than that. But suffice it to say that people who believe that life is sacred and that that life begins at conception, we will continue to argue about when does life begin. But I want to be very careful about this amendment, because this amendment does not take a woman's right to abortion away. We cannot do that in the state. That decision was made back in 1973 by Roe versus Wade, by the Supreme Court. And no matter what we write in our Constitution about trying to take a woman's right to abortion away, we cannot do that. And that is not the purpose of this resolution that I'm trying to do. The purpose of this is to get us back to neutrality, where we were before Planned Parenthood came in and sued the state. And we had a decision that was made by a very liberal Supreme Court that actually had rights broader than what the Supreme Court and Roe versus Wade gave. And so our Supreme Court made decisions that made those rights even greater than what a woman would have had under the Supreme Court decision. And fundamentally what it did was it had an unlimited right to abortion, which means that our state legislature is not the one making the laws. It was the Supreme Court who made the laws, and that's another argument for another day about who is it in, when we look at the powers that we have set up with the executive branch and the judicial branch and the legislative branch, it's the legislative branch that has the right to make the laws. And the Supreme Court, the judicial branch, actually took that right away from us. It gave a greater right to abortion than what was even given by the Supreme Court decision. And I know all of this is a lot of legal mumbo-jumbo to some people, and I've tried to break it down to be something that folks could understand. But that is to say, anything at all that we would put by the legislature into our code to try to protect a woman if that decision were to be made is going to be judged at a higher standard than that would be judged if it were being judged at the standard at the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court level. And their standard is undue burden. So let's say, for instance, if we were to limit, or let's say, for instance, we talked about informed consent, and we'd say, is it an undue burden, if we were using the standard of the U.S. Supreme Court, is it an undue burden to ask that an informed consent would be given to someone? And if you were to compare that to any other surgery, you'd say, well, no, why would that be any more undue burden to have an informed consent than it would be for an abortion than it would be for a gallbladder, let's say? And then it would be able to stand. But what happened with our Supreme Court is they went above that. They went to the next level up, and they call that strict scrutiny. So anything that we would put in the code would be judged by strict scrutiny and not undue burden. And that holds us to a higher standard and pretty much gives unlimited right to abortion without there being any safeguards that could be put into place. Does that make sense?
Well, it makes sense legally, but it doesn't make any sense morally, because it essentially says that a woman that has the desire to get an abortion can take any risky means, risky for herself, in addition to risky for the fetus, of course.
I think there's no doubt there's a risk to the fetus, because once that decision is made, that fetus has no rights.
What I mean is that there have been cases of women that went in to have an abortion,
And I think there was one in New York City about 5 years ago that was nationally famous, in which the abortionist botched the procedure, mm-hmm. and then the baby was born prematurely, but the arms were cut off by the mm-hmm. abortion machine.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is no safeguard against that mm-hmm. Under the current law, and it's fascinating. Now, with my background, I worked for several years as a paralegal. I don't do that currently. But when you said that the Planned Parenthood lawsuit was Planned Parenthood versus Sundquist, I find that fascinating because I don't know if you read about this in the news, but Governor Bredesen has this facility that they want to build at the governor's mansion, the so-called Bredesen Bunker, the mm-hmm. underground party hall.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm the one that filed a lawsuit in Wilson County Chancery Court, because I live in Wilson County, to try and stop the building of this facility. And it was dismissed from court because of a little-known statute. The judge even said that other public officials have been through his courtroom and were unaware of the statute. Their attorneys were unaware of the statute. So it's a little-known statute that says that if you want to sue the state, then you can only do so in Chancery Court in Davidson County, where the state capitol is located. Now, the state attorney that showed up in court also made an argument, but it didn't go very far because the case was already dismissed, but he made the point that there's another statute that says that you cannot sue the governor in his capacity as an official of the state. And this attorney went on to say that the First Lady is also an official of the state, which I found ridiculous. But my point is that the left wants to be so Machiavellian because they want it both ways. When it suits them, well, you can sue the governor. But when it doesn't suit them, you can't sue the governor. And, you know, it's just like they will bend all the rules in order to get whatever they want and then hurl the rules at us. And it just makes no sense to me whatsoever.
Well, there are a lot of things that just really don't make sense, and especially to common sense people, such as it sounds as though you're a common sense person, and much of the folks that I represent, or many of the folks that I represent, the greater majority of them are people who think as we do in the common sense terms, and sometimes things get turned upside down because when we look at our laws and our prohibitions against doing certain things, they are not common sense.
Absolutely not. The government will go to great lengths to make sure that there is a wall built between the side of the store that sells beer and the side of the store that sells liquor, but they won't protect an unborn baby.
Mm-hmm.
It just amazes me, some of the restrictions in place by our government and then the things that are really important we seem to miss out on. So if you will, please explain to our listeners then exactly what it is that your proposed amendment will do, because we've now defined the parameters of what it won't do. So what exactly does your amendment propose to do?
Well, the amendment actually puts us back into the position of neutrality, and we have to use pretty severe words in order to be able to do that. And I know that folks get really upset about the wording that we're using, but these words are the words that our legal advisors tell us that we must use in order for us to get back to neutrality. And that says, because the Supreme Court's decision was, is that there was a fundamental right for a woman to have her right to abortion, we have to put back into the Constitution the words that there is no fundamental right to abortion provided in our Constitution. And you'd say, well, why do those words have to be that way? It sounds like we're going to take a woman's total right to abortion away. Well, first of all, we can't do that. But second of all, that's the language we must use in order to get us back to neutrality. This is not something that the state or the legislature decided that it wanted to do because there was a whim. It's done as a reaction to what happened back in 2000. And in order to get back to neutrality, we have to say that our Constitution, and it literally does not, if you were to go in the Constitution and look for the word abortion, you won't find it, but that our Constitution does not provide for this fundamental right. And it gets us back then to the point where we can put into the Constitution, or excuse me, put into the law these protections, and then the women of the state will be under the same kind of protections they have for abortions as they were previous to 2000, and that is through the Roe versus Wade decision. So they're still going to have protection. We cannot take that away. It is a right that was given to them by the U.S. Supreme Court in that decision of Roe versus Wade, and I don't want people to go around misleading others about what this does. It just puts us back to the point of neutrality.
And that makes perfect sense. And interestingly enough, so this condition that Tennessee was under from 1973 until 2000, 27 years, fell within the guidelines of the United States Supreme Court decision. And yet that wasn't good enough for Planned Parenthood. They had to have more.
They wanted to go over and beyond that to make sure that the legislature could not fully inform women about what was going on, because once a woman is fully informed and told all of these pieces that we've already talked about, there are many times a different decision made than if they're not given that information. Then later, after, this is a very emotional time, after things are settled and they find out all of the facts and the understanding of truly what has happened to them and what has happened to their unborn child, there are a lot of consequences that take place. And there are a number of organizations that help women through those very difficult decisions afterwards, and help them to forgive themselves if that is part of what the counseling is that they need once they have that understanding. And we want those to be decisions that are made with full informed consent, so that they don't have to worry about afterwards getting a piece of information that they didn't have beforehand and thinking, if I would have had that piece of information, I may not have made that decision. It's only fair that they have all of the information. They're completely informed prior to making the decision about the procedure.
And when the people on the left call themselves pro-choice, if they were really for choice, choice is made out of an informed decision. And so if you don't have all the information, you're not really making a proper choice. Well, they don't care, because they only want you to make one choice. And so I know you can't say that, but I can.
Well, I think that's pretty obvious. If you were not afraid of informed consent, then why would you be fighting so hard against it? If you were confident that if someone had an informed consent, they would make the same decision if they did not, then why would you be fighting it? Why would you not just say, well, I agree with you. I think that a woman should have informed consent. I believe that she should know fully, because I'm so confident that she's going to make the same decision if she were to have it, if she did not have it.
You're right. Before I moved to Tennessee in the summer of 2001, I used to live in upstate New York. And back in the early 90s, there was a change in the state law. And so New York State was the first country, or the first state in the country, to pass a law that said that parents had to be informed. Mm-hmm. And so what happened? Planned Parenthood, Pennsylvania passed a law that required parents to be notified.
Mm-hmm.
And so Planned Parenthood in Binghamton, New York, where I used to live, offered a shuttle van service wherein they would drive down to Scranton, Pennsylvania, and pick up young women, and it didn't matter to them if they were high school girls, and transport them across state lines back to New York to get an abortion, and then drive them back so that their parents would think they were at school. And in the meantime, they were in another state having an abortion. And I told the newspaper at that time that this was going to become a national problem, and eventually it did. And so it seems to me that the left is just relentless. And to borrow a phrase from Chuck Swindoll, sometimes it's like trying to nail Jell-O to the side of a tree in order to put any restrictions whatsoever on this dangerous procedure, and a procedure that is just a moral blight upon our land.
It is very concerning, because people who believe so strongly in abortion, when you talk to them, there's just not that zest for life, and it hurts my soul to think that people think of life as being so trivial that we can just take a life and not have some kind of result in the other end. And again, this is a very emotional time for a woman who has had an unplanned pregnancy. And when you're in an emotional crisis, you should have every bit of assistance and support that you can to make the best decision, because later on, it's too late. Kind of like you're talking about the amputation. You can't put it back on. You can't bring the baby back to life.
You can't unring the bell. Now, this Sunday, this program, this particular interview is being recorded on Friday, but on Sunday, the 20th of January, Tennessee Right to Life will have a rally at the War Memorial Plaza downtown, across from the state capitol, downtown Nashville. Now, if I remember correctly, aren't you one of the speakers?
I will be speaking very briefly about the position that the resolution is in currently in the General Assembly. So I'm not one of the key speakers, but I will be making some brief remarks.
And that starts at what time?
That starts at 2 o'clock at the Sheraton Hotel down in the downtown area.
Right. So for those of you that are listening on our RBN affiliate in Maryville, Tennessee, if you're really serious about wanting to join the statewide fight against abortion, if you're so inclined, there is time to get on I-40 and make it to Nashville before 2 o'clock. And people that are listening via the Internet in the Nashville area in Middle Tennessee, encourage you to come down and show your support by attending that rally 2 p.m. at War Memorial Plaza on Capitol Hill in downtown Nashville, Tennessee. Senator Black, I really appreciate you taking the time to call in and be our guest here on the U.S. Phone Force, and I will email you once it shows up in the archives the entire program so that you'll have that available if you like, and encourage you and appreciate you being here and encourage you to come back anytime.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and thank you for your stand on life.
Well, thank you so much, and you have a good day, and hopefully my wife and I will see you downtown Sunday afternoon.
Thank you. I look forward to that.
All right. Thanks.
Okay, bye-bye.
We are back live with more of the U.S. Phone Force here on the Republic Broadcasting Network. That was an interview recorded earlier this week with State Senator Dianne Black of Tennessee. And as it was mentioned in the recorded interview, this afternoon, if you're listening in Tennessee, there will be a rally sponsored by the Tennessee Right to Life organization down at the Legislative Plaza, which is on Capitol Hill in the heart of downtown Nashville, across the street from the state capitol, at 2 p.m. today, 1400 hours. And that rally will have several speakers. One of them will be State Senator Dianne Black. And since we're now back live, we're ready to take your calls at 1-800-313-9443. And our topic for the remainder of this hour is presidential politics. And there were some things that came up in the news, and one of them I found kind of interesting. And I know that a number of Republican Broadcasting listeners like Ron Paul and support Ron Paul. I personally do like Ron Paul, and those of you that have followed my work may know that back in October he spoke in Nashville, and I was selected to do the sign language interpretation for his speech at the rally. So I got to pay very close attention to his Nashville speech and stood right next to him on the stage and got to speak with him very briefly afterward, and enjoyed that. I found him to be very personable. He's a very bright fellow, and he has a number of ideas that I agree with. He also has a couple of areas that I've referred to in my columns as blind spots, and those are unfortunately, in some cases for some voters, are Achilles heels as far as voting for Ron Paul. But I'd like to know your thoughts. 1-800-313-9443 to contact the U.S. Phone Force here on the Republic Broadcasting Network. If you're listening online and for any reason you can't call in, you can also email the show at radio@tomkovach.us. Kovach is spelled K-O-V-A-C-H, just like it sounds, and it's not .com, it's .us. So that address again is radio@tomkovach.us. Now, one of the events that's going on today is a barbecue, a fundraising barbecue being held in Texas about an hour east of the headquarters of the Republic Broadcasting Network, and that fundraiser is being sponsored by no less than Mr. Chuck Norris. Now, Chuck Norris has a weekly column on WorldNet Daily, and in his column about 3 months ago, he endorsed Governor Mike Huckabee for president, and Governor Huckabee, within a few days after that WorldNet Daily endorsement, began to enjoy what has come to be known as the Huckaboom. His polling numbers have gone up, and they have stayed up ever since, which seems to be a testimony to the star power of Chuck Norris. However, what do you think? Do you think, first of all, that the endorsement was a good idea? Do you think that Chuck Norris was fully informed, to use some language from the previous interview about abortion? Did Chuck Norris make a fully informed decision about former Governor Mike Huckabee? Has it altered in any way your view of Chuck Norris? Were you swayed by his endorsement? Did that endorsement cause you to take another look at Governor Mike Huckabee? And ladies and gentlemen, our first caller from Tennessee, we have John. John, welcome to the U.S. Phone Force.
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. Ladies and gentlemen, this is one of my regular callers. This is John, who is a truck driver. And, John, are you on the road today?
I'm working, but I'm stationary right now.
Okay.
I'm not as much a regular caller, Tom. I appreciate you introducing me that way. But the reason I called, I enjoyed your interview, and I know you're on presidential politics, so I won't keep you long.
That's okay.
I wanted to offer a couple of books if anyone is really interested in the abortion in the abortion industry and the debate. A couple books that are must reads. One was by George Grant. It was written in the 80s. The title was Grand Illusions: The Legacy of Planned Parenthood. And in that book, it's about a 10-year endeavor, but it's meticulous, and it's an easy read, and it exposes Margaret Sanger and the entire abortion industry and what's really behind it and the entire eugenics movement. And you and I have talked before, and I think that's the majority of the problems in this world is an attempt to engineer an attempt to eliminate people that are less than desirable, the ones that won't necessarily jump in lockstep with what they're being told, were useless to them, Tom. And if they can do anything they can do to eliminate us, they're going to do it. The other book is a book called Better for All the World. The author is Harry, and I want to say Belarus or Bella, a hard name to remember, but it is basically a documentary book on the whole forced sterilization movement of the 20s in America, which a lot of people don't realize that's where Hitler got his ideas, was from America's forced sterilization movement and the eugenics movement.
And there are two interesting points, John, one of which we've discussed before, but it certainly bears repeating, and that is that if we humans are made in the image of God, which I believe that we are, and I know you do, then how can other humans dare? And that's really the only word that fits here. How can human beings dare to try and re-engineer the human body to sort of outdo God with this genetic engineering? Dare we think, any of us, great or small, that we can out-engineer the creator of the universe?
Well, I put it in a lot easier. The way that I do it, I'm a truck driver, so the way that I do it is, how on earth do we believe that we can improve on the creation of the creator when he looked back and he said it was good? The only explanation I can come up with, Tom, is the people that are behind the whole genetic engineering industry, and that's what it is. There's tons of money to be made. Have an ulterior motive. And it is not only to make money, it is to do their best to become something more than man, maybe a feeble attempt, definitely a feeble attempt to become godlike without having to go through God. That's the only way I can put it.
You know, that brings up an interesting parallel in and of itself, because Satan, in his rantings in Isaiah chapter 14, declared, I will be like the Most High God. And so what you're saying is that people in this eugenics and genetic engineering are perhaps trying from the human level to do the very same thing that Satan tried to do in the spiritual realm, and that is to become like God.
Absolutely, and that can take, that could be a whole nother program. I won't take you there. That could
okay.
be a whole nother program for months and months and months. If it
Absolutely.
Ever really clicked with people as to what's behind all of this. Now back, I'll leave it at that, and I'll go back to presidential politics for a minute. I was enthused when I saw Ron Paul's showing in Nevada.
Oh, absolutely.
A second. Now, granted, it was, what, 13 or 14%, but it was still second place. You know, Rudy Giuliani was 3 or 4%. Thompson was 3 or 4%, if I recall correctly. But yet, we see the controlled media, even though, yes, it's only Nevada, but even in South Carolina yesterday, Ron Paul was ahead of Giuliani, but yet the Sean Hannitys of the world and the different shows and the controlled media refused to give Ron Paul what I believe, if they would have given him a fair shake in the beginning and actually allowed him and demanded from the other candidates before they ever had a debate, at least say, look, guys, when we go into this, we're going to go into this and we're going to offer one another the due respect. And we're going to be able to agree to disagree. If we disagree, fine. But you don't do it by name calling. If someone brings something up and you can refute it using your intellect, then let's do it. But if you're going to roll your eyes, or if you're going to get all these CFR guys to pile on to Ron Paul, you know, America, unfortunately, is asleep, Tom. They don't see it. And when you tell them, they say, well, you know, I'm looking for a winner. Well, you're going to destroy the primary process when you're voting for someone that you believe is electable. So get that through your head right now. Vote your heart in the primary. And personally, when the general comes, if it's not someone that I can stand behind, they're not, none of them are getting my vote. I'll listen. I don't want to commandeer your show, man. I can talk to you about any time we need to, but I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for calling in, John. You've made some very good points indeed. I think that everyone needs to make a fully informed decision, and one of the key points is that, yes, there does seem to be some media engineering. A couple of examples of that in the case of Ron Paul in particular is that in those cases in which Ron Paul has actually done better than the what I would call the machinery candidates, those that have the big party machinery behind them, Fred Thompson comes to mind. This is at least the second time that Ron Paul has beaten Fred Thompson by a significant margin. One was in the polling just prior to the New Hampshire primary. Ron Paul was several percentage points ahead of Fred Thompson. What was the news media's reaction to that? They talked about John McCain and Rudy Giuliani, and they just totally omitted the names Ron Paul and Fred Thompson. And so that way they got around any discussion of the significant progress that Congressman Paul had made. Now, in the case of Nevada, here we have a case where this was not a poll, this was the actual primary election, and Ron Paul has beaten Fred Thompson. Will we hear that in the lamestream news media? I doubt it. But even so, a significant factor to consider in the case of Nevada is that the news media also makes a big deal when they talk about smaller party politics. They mentioned the Libertarian Party. The Constitution Party gets very little, if any, mention. Now, before I go any farther with what I'm about to say, I want to give a full disclosure disclaimer and let our listeners know that I am the state PR coordinator for the Constitution Party of Tennessee. So, you know, I do have, if you will, a vested political interest in this. But the facts remain the facts, and the fact is that the Constitution Party, by voter registration, is the third largest party in America. Now, I refer to it using the term smaller party politics instead of the term third party politics, because even the language itself forces people to think, oh, well, if I vote for a third party, I'm outside the mainstream of America. You know, we have a two-party system in America. No, we don't. Find it for me in the Constitution. Find it for me in the Declaration of Independence. Find it for me anywhere in the election laws of the first 100 years of the United States of America. In fact, the first 150 years. There is no such thing as a two-party system in America. It is an invention of the same news media that is trying to control how people vote. Now, having said all that, in Nevada, there is a very unique situation in that, again, the Libertarian Party gets a lot of news mention, but in Nevada, the Constitution Party has seven times as many members as the Libertarian Party. Did you catch that, ladies and gentlemen? Seven times the membership of the Libertarian Party. And yet the Constitution Party will probably not get any mention in the news media discussions of the presidential primary. Ladies and gentlemen, in late April, the National Constitution Party Presidential Nominating Convention is coming up. That is several months prior to the nominating conventions of the big two political parties. So think about that, ladies and gentlemen. What if the Constitution Party comes up with a ticket that puts the Republican Party on notice and possibly can win over also those conservative Democrats, also known as the Reagan Democrats or the Dixie Democrats or the Dixiecrats? Now, living in Middle Tennessee, I can tell you that there are a lot of conservatives conservative Dixiecrats running around. And those are the people that did not vote for native son Al Gore. They are the people that also put Ronald Reagan into the White House in 1980, and they are a force to be contended with. And ladies and gentlemen, those people, I believe, are crossing over to the Constitution Party in record numbers, and those that have not formally joined the Constitution Party, I believe, will vote on the Constitution Party line in those states where the Constitution Party has a ballot line. Now, right now in Tennessee, we do not have a ballot line. But at the national level, there is a lawsuit that is pending that will sue certain states. And we have joined forces with those with whom we otherwise might disagree. Now, the constitutionists and the libertarians probably agree on about 80% of issues, but one of the serious disagreements is over abortion. But we have joined with the Libertarian Party and the Green Party, with whom we have very few agreements, but we all believe that there should be a level political playing field. And so those three parties, the Constitution Party, the Libertarian Party, and the Green Party, have joined forces to file a lawsuit to force the state of Tennessee to put those three parties on the election ballot in this coming election cycle. If that happens, then it is entirely possible that for the first time in 100 years, the people of Tennessee will have, in fact, more than 100 years, the people of Tennessee will have a choice for president other than the Democrats and the Republicans. Now, I have to backtrack for a moment. In 2004, the Constitution Party was able to get its candidate, Michael Perutka, and running mate, Dr. Chuck Baldwin, on the ballot. So there was a presidential choice in 2004, so I misspoke a minute ago. But that was only by significant effort. But the difference was that in 2004, that was only a temporary measure, and it was only for president and vice president. There was no choice below that line. So in other words, in 2004, while you could vote in Tennessee for a Constitution Party president and vice president, you could not vote for a Constitution Party governor or United States senator or United States congressman, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it was only on the line for president. The difference now is that if this lawsuit is successful, you will be able to vote for a Constitution Party member for county legislature or any of the other offices that I just mentioned a minute ago. So that is significant. The Constitution Party is growing by leaps and bounds. So what do you think? Call-in number is area code 800-313-9443. And you can email the show at radio@tomkovach.us. And Kovach is spelled K-O-V-A-C-H. You can visit my website at www.tomkovach.us. And there you can see some background information. You can also purchase my book, Slingshot, which is a collection of some of the best of my columns from the first 3 years of my online columns. Those were at Men's News Daily and Renew America. I also now, in addition to writing for Renew America, where I have a recurring column, I also write for Military.com and WorldNet Daily on occasion. So you can also pick up my columns there. So what do you think about all these topics of presidential politics? Is it possible that a true constitutionist, whether Ron Paul or someone else, could get on the ballot across the country? Could that person actually win? Is it possible that because the Constitution Party's convention is months prior, that the Constitution Party could dictate to the Republican Party to move to the right? Do you think those are possibilities? And specifically, and this is a key question, who would you want to see on that ballot? I know that a high percentage of Republic Broadcasting Network listeners are Constitution Party members. Who would you want to see on a Constitution Party ticket? Now, I'm going to throw out some possibilities to stimulate conversation. And we're running out of time in this hour, so if you want to get in on this discussion, you need to call right away to 800-313-9443. What do you think if the Constitution Party should put Ron Paul at the top of the ticket and Congressman Duncan Hunter for vice president? Or Ron Paul and Dr. Jerome Corsi? Or what about, why don't we reverse it? What about Duncan Hunter at the top of the ticket and Ron Paul as vice president? Now, I've written in a recent piece that I don't think Dr. Paul would go for that, but I'm just throwing it out for the sake of stimulating some conversation. And here's a man who's raised $20 million in a very short time, $5 million of it, if I recall correctly, in a single day back in early November, in a big internet push. Would somebody like that be willing to play second chair? I tend to doubt it myself, but what do you think? Now, another possibility, what about Congressman Duncan Hunter for president and Dr. Jerome Corsi for vice president? Just food for thought. What do you think of those possibilities? Now, I'm not talking out of school here. In other words, I mean, I know that people have discussed all these possibilities in various ways. This does not reveal any secret inside information or anything like that. These are just questions, food for thought, for you to call into the program. Now, I will mention, as I said that I would, even though I have mixed feelings and I would like to find out more about this, Chuck Norris did endorse former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee for president. Now, Chuck Norris and I, this may surprise you, have quite a few things in common. Both of us served in the Air Force. Both of us did the same job in the Air Force. Chuck Norris served one term and then got out of the Air Force. I was career Air Force. We were both in law enforcement in the Air Force. I went on to become a law enforcement supervisor. We both practiced martial arts for many years, both spent a year in Korea. We both respect Oriental culture. We're both very fond of history, and especially the history of the American West. We enjoy cowboy culture. We've both ridden horses for a lot of years, jumped out of airplanes, and we're both have books on the market, and we're conservative-minded, outspoken. Since 19-